You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. This week, my guest is Emmy and Peabody Award-winning journalist Sarah Spain. A through line in Sarah's life and work has always been her curiosity and her remarkable willingness to try new things. As a kid and teenager, Sarah played lots of different sports, and she was in the band, chorus, and theater as well. In college, she competed as a heptathlete at Cornell University and served as the co-captain of the track and field team. After college, Sarah worked for a variety of blogs, radio stations, and other media outlets. And in 2010, she joined ESPN and has since served as a columnist for ESPNW, a SportsCenter reporter, a host of numerous podcasts, and she's appeared on lots of different programs on the network, including The Dan Le Batard Show, Around the Horn, and more. Sarah's done radio, podcasting, TV, writing, producing, and so much more. And now she's still doing a variety of projects for ESPN, and she's in the process of writing her own book. And throughout it all, she is still committed to her lifelong dream of one day being on Saturday Night Live. And personally, I believe that she is going to make it happen. Sarah and I caught up towards the end of 2023 for what was a really fun, wide-ranging, and thought-provoking conversation. She shared a behind-the-scenes look at her extraordinary career and many of the secrets that power her remarkable success every day. In our conversation, you'll hear lessons on how to adapt to new roles, become a better listener, overcome adversity with creative solutions, and so much more. This episode will help you push your boundaries and transform curiosity, empathy, and versatility into a superpower. I know that I am going to be thinking about this conversation for a very long time. It's filled with so many ideas and lessons to help all of us become the best versions of ourselves, both personally and professionally. This conversation was a ton of fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it. So, let's pull the tarp and get straight to Sarah Spain. Where I want to begin, so throughout your life as a kid, you played so many different sports, field hockey, basketball, track, tennis, horseback riding, and golf. I'm looking at my notes because there's so many that I want to make sure I remember them all. When you went to Cornell, you were a heptathlete. And again, I want to make sure I have this right. Heptathletes, long jump, high jump, hurdles, 800, 200, shot put, javelin. Did I miss anything?
That's right.
So I'm curious, has versatility and being well-rounded and trying different things, has that always been something that's been a part of you, that's something that you've been drawn to?
Yeah, it's actually literally the sort of through line for my life is jack of all trades, master of none. Partly because I don't know if I have the focus to be the greatest at anything. Momentarily, I can be. I get really into whatever I'm working on at any given time, and I will devote all my energy to it. But I love to know different things, do different things, try different things. So I don't know that I've ever had the real capacity to just say, this is the thing I'm going to devote myself to. Even my career at ESPN, it's been radio, podcasting, writing, television, producing, like literally all the things. So yeah, I mean, I think I grew up and I was just a massive competitor. I wanted to compete at anything. I turned anything into a competition. And I was really tall and athletic growing up. So it was a space that I felt really comfortable in. And because I wanted to do all the things, it kind of kept me from focusing on any one. And then that really became like writ large when the heptathlon became my focus, was the ability to be good at lots of things. I also did band, chorus, like theater, all the stuff. Some might say, pick a lane. I prefer not to.
I'm curious, Sarah, because I know you're a Chicago sports fan. And a number of months ago, Ben Zobrist was on the podcast, and we talked all about his extraordinary career and the fact that he played every position on the field at the major league level except for catcher.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he told me when I asked him about his adaptability and his versatility, he said the key to it all was that I was willing to play all the positions and I prepared to play all of those positions before any coach or anybody in the organization asked me to. And I'm curious, how do you think about preparation for different roles and different things that you get involved in? Like, how do you prepare to be a jack of all trades, but a master of none? Although I think you've mastered quite a bit.
Thank you. So I would say some of it comes quite naturally. I'm extremely curious. So I want to read everything. I want to learn everything. I just find it fascinating to know about as much as I can about the world and people and things and life. So that's been a through line forever and something that I didn't really need to be taught through any life lessons. But I'll say that when I moved to LA after college, I was an English major. I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. I still do. I refuse to ever let that dream die, no matter how old I get, no matter how incapable I might be of ever getting there. I'm always going to say that's the dream. And so I actually wanted to get into comedy and acting when I moved to LA after college. I had been a three-sport athlete, all state in band and chorus. Sports were all right after school, so I wasn't really doing theater the way that someone who was interested in doing it for a career might, but I also knew that sports had this really limited timeline. I wasn't going to go to the Olympics or be a professional, so if I wanted to play, it was going to be sort of high school, college, and then I could turn my focus to seeing if I really wanted to do the acting and the comedy stuff. So I moved out to LA and kind of stumbled into sports. There were not a lot of women doing it when I was growing up, and there certainly weren't any that got to be sort of funny in the way that I wanted to be. And so it didn't even occur to me. And no one ever mentioned it to me, despite being sports crazed and an athlete. Not a single person was like, do you want to work in sports? Have you ever thought about working in sports? So it wasn't until I was hosting a fake Chicago Bears show in a TV hosting boot camp class that the teacher said, oh, you want to work in sports? I was like, oh, no, I'm just using this to practice, you know, throwing to break and teases. I want to be on E or whatever the class was for. And so when I stumbled into it, what I found was there was so much catching up to do on sports, but that I brought all of this other stuff to the table that was really helpful and useful. You know, there's radio folks, especially in sports, who that's really all they've ever cared about. And they cannot make a reference to movies, books, literature, history, right? It's sports and it's great. They could tell you whoever had the most home runs in like 1972, but they will not know the plot of like one of the most basic famous books of all time kind of thing. And so what I found is I had all these experiences trying to do the acting thing that made for great stories. I had all sorts of other stuff I was interested in, and I brought it to the table and it made me more interesting in the sports world as well. And so when I started doing my own podcast and I wanted to have every kind of guest possible, from sommeliers to neuroscientists to SNL cast members to athletes and coaches, I could have these really wide-ranging conversations and be knowledgeable and have interesting things to talk to them about across the board. And that's been, I think, it was a lesson I learned coming into sports, where I had to make good use of a talent that I had, since I was deficient in the like knowing every stat from every single game kind of thing. And it's ended up being more who I want to be in general. So yeah, I mean, I think the preparation comes from a natural curiosity. And then there's a real desire that's a through line of, when I learn something or find out something fascinating, I want to share it with everyone. So it ends up being really easy in interviews or conversations to be like, oh, speaking of that, do you know about this? And have you heard of this? And then it just drives me to want to learn more.
About the curiosity, you said it was something that's kind of always been natural to you. Do you think that it is truly natural? Do you think there are people at an early age that modeled that behavior and the importance of curiosity for you?
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about my book later. I'm getting into lots of subjects of nature versus nurture. So I'm fascinated by what things might be sort of inherent and natural versus what you learn from watching. But it's probably both. I mean, my parents are both super well-read, really into culture. They took me to a lot of Broadway and musicals and all different stuff growing up, in addition to playing tennis and sports and other things. So I think certainly they contributed to me being super well-rounded, because they're really interested in all sorts of things and traveling and everything else. But yeah, I mean, I think there's people whose minds, like, for instance, my husband, he loves a rabbit hole, right? But the rabbit hole sometimes comes at the expense of like whatever he was working on, right? Like, he'll be working on something and then he'll be like, oh, I forgot about that guy from the 1984 Cars music video for whatever. And then doop, doop, doop. And then like 30 minutes later, he could tell you all about that. I don't know how useful it is, but like, that's the way his brain works. Mine is more about like wanting to truly understand something deeply and sticking with that in the moment that I'm in it. And so, for instance, like I had a podcast guest who mentioned neuroplasticity and the idea that taxi drivers' brains are thicker in the area where they do directions. And it was one of the studies that helped them understand that if you use repetition, you can change the way your brain works without having to be intentional about it. So things like gratitude practices, if you force yourself to do them every day, you tell your brain, I want to create like bridges to get to that faster. And then it goes there without you asking, even in moments of stress or frustration, it'll find a way to get you back to, well, I'm grateful I'm in this traffic now because I don't have a meeting to get to. So I get to finish this podcast I'm listening to, right? It starts doing it naturally without you needing to choose that because you've told it over and over, this is where I want to go. Like a guest mentioned that once and I didn't know much about it. And once I like learned about it and thought about all the applications, especially for people who have depression or people who struggle to find that silver lining on a regular basis, I was like, all right, now I want to know about this. Now I'm going to have a neuroscientist on. Now I'm going to read a book about it. So I think maybe not everybody wants to do that all the time when they don't know about something. When I don't know about something, not everything. There's some things that I'm like, try as I might, like NASCAR, I don't care. I don't need to know about drafting. It's just not my thing. But there's certain things I don't care about. But when I am interested, then it becomes like, I'm just a constant learner.
I'm so with you on this, Sarah. On this podcast, I've had over 165 conversations with Olympic athletes, pro athletes, Grammy winners, TV stars, elite coaches at the pro and college level, broadcasters, journalists, best-selling authors of all kinds of genres, CEOs, entrepreneurs. And I'm constantly amazed at how the lessons are kind of interconnected and how powerful it is to take a lesson from a discipline that's like seemingly unrelated and how you can apply it something else. Like, and for example, I keep in touch with a lot of coaches that have been on this podcast, and they say, you know, Andrew, I learn a lot more than you would think from the authors that you interview as compared to the other peer coaches, because I know what a lot of the coaches are talking about and have heard a lot of those talk tracks, but how the author is looking at something, that is really, really fascinating to me. And I'm trying to figure out how I can apply that to conversation I'm having with my players. And the other thing that's amazing to me, and I'm curious if you see this as well, is I may have had a conversation in 2020 with someone, and I look at the transcript or listen back to it, and I kind of jot down 7 or 8 lessons that I want to remember. And then I look back at it in 2 or 3 years, and there's like 5 or 10 more lessons that I really want to remember or things that I'm looking at differently. Do you feel the same way about all the conversations that you've had and all these different things that you've explored?
Yeah. I mean, my role changed with ESPN in the last year, so the podcast had been on hiatus. And so when I did my last episode, I just sort of said, I hope we're coming back at some point. I'm doing some other stuff, but I want to be back. And I tried to kind of really think about big picture. And I think I was over 380 something episodes. So it was, a year plus of every day, if I had done it, of conversations. And the biggest things I took away were how many lessons I learned from people doing things the opposite way than I always thought was how you found success, and how some of them got to places that I'd always wanted to be and never got, in part because of that and what I could learn from that. It also made me so much less critical of people who do things differently than me, because I started to see how many different ways there are of being and succeeding and thriving instead of this very narrow. I'm just the most basic control freak type A, get straight A's, go to Ivy League, work really hard. Like that was always just this very simple, this is how you do it. You just like work super hard all the time and then good things will happen, right? And the number of particularly people who were doing something that I'd always wanted to do. So comedians, Saturday Night Live cast members, actors, really successful people in Hollywood, which is what I'd always wanted. Hated school, didn't try, dropped out, and had this thing about them that drove them to something that wasn't that prescribed, follow this path. And so sometimes I wonder if I got so stuck on the idea of like, do all the things the way you're supposed to and you'll get where you want to be, not realizing that there's places that you get to it using a completely different way. That's not to say that I don't respect where I am and also maybe don't have a better understanding for maybe this is where I'm meant to be. Like the idea of that sounds great, but maybe that's not the kind of person and the kind of skill sets I have. Maybe I'm a little too rigid, but it has helped me try to be less rigid, less stuck in the way that I do things. But yeah, I mean, I miss the podcast more than any, well, okay. I miss Around the Horn the most because it's like the perfect combination of trash talking and sports. And I just love that family of people. And that is another one that, fingers crossed, we're coming back to, we're working on it. But I think the podcast I miss so much because what I would do is just find anything I found interesting and then task myself as part of my job to like read the book, interview the person, study the thing, and get to know it more. And every time I go back and listen, I'm like, whoa, I would have asked something completely different 2 years ago than what my brain says right now. Oh, ooh, ask them this when I go back and listen. And that's the fascinating part, is to just like keep reminding, like, it's so sad to me, people who are stuck and they like don't want to keep learning and evolving, because that's the coolest thing to me. It's like to look back, hopefully not too cringy, like not like look back and be like, oh shit, like that, I totally stepped in it. But to look back and be like, okay, I see things differently now.
I'm totally with you on this, Sarah. And I'm so curious about the comedy and the improv. And like, what did you take away most? If you had to distill it down to like one or two things, like what did you take away most from the experience at the Second City Conservatory and that whole experience? Like, what? Tell me about that.
I would say two things. The thing I took away from trying to get into acting right after college was that I had had so few deep lived experiences. This is a positive in almost any other place. I had no trauma. I had a wonderful family. I had great privileged upbringing. I had a great time in high school. I loved all my friends. I loved going to college. The worst things that happened to me were, I mean, I think also it's perspective, right? Like, I don't dwell on things. I pivot and try to figure out how to make them work for me. But the worst things that happened were I tore my Achilles and I couldn't do heptathlon anymore. And so my senior year, I just tried to throw javelin. And had I known that all these years later, it would still be messing me up, I might have been a little sadder at the time. At the time, I was like, them's the breaks, work through it. And then I wanted to be a singer and I had to get surgery on my vocal cords. I had nodes on my vocal cords. And so I kind of knew that the singing career was never going to happen, because even after the surgery, they started to go. And I used to be a high soprano and now I sound like this. So I guess that's why I do sports radio. But I suppose if I had been the kind of person who dramatically sulks in their room for months about like, oh, the career I could have had if not for my Achilles and my vocal cords, like maybe I would have saw that as more traumatic and pulled from it. But what I found in my classes for acting was I didn't have a lot to pull from for anything beyond being funny. I didn't have reference points for being a human in the tragedy of life. And it was a great thing to have as far as being alive, but terrible for acting, like just terrible. I was very one note. I was too surface. From Second City, by far, that is the reason that I really pride myself on being a great interviewer, is listening to every single word and not being ready to move on to the next thing, needing to know exactly what your scene partner said, because you have to keep that up. If at the beginning of the scene, they said, my brother, Jim, and later on you say your brother, Kevin, the audience remembers and they're taken out of it. If you are ready to move on to the scene that you want to have happen and you're already thinking of it, and then they say something and you can't go there anymore because it wouldn't make sense, you've wasted all this time concocting something and being ready for it instead of waiting until you get to the moment where it's your time to step in and change it and move the scene along. And that is the advice that I give people all the time for interviewing, is you're watching someone moderate a panel or talk to someone and they're waiting to stop talking so they can go back to their card and say the next thing. And if you're ever listening to an interview or watching a panel and somebody says something that has the perfect, like there's a follow-up and the whole audience wants to know and they keep it moving and you're like, no, wait, they just said there's only one person I've ever really hated working with. And you just like kept it moving, like those kind of things. So I would say that was the biggest thing, was like, no matter what you have next, or no matter how much you want to make something go in the direction that you want, it's about that, going back and forth and being ready for whatever they say next.
So coach me up, Sarah. I'm interviewing right now and I want to know, how can I be a better listener? How can anybody listening become a better listener, whether it's during in an interview format or just at a coffee shop when they're talking to a friend? Right.
Okay, this is something I need to work on in life more so than work. I do a great job in work because I've had it instilled in me, like, you're not the story, don't make it about you, like all this other stuff. And then in life, my husband's like, okay, settle down now. They weren't done with the story and you're ready to jump in with like your story. So I'm working on the interrupting and the talking to, it's, I remember Max Kellerman once was talking to Levitard about how like the skills that he needed for First Take, which is you have 2 hours to fill and like slow day. So just like milk it and repeat it and get after, like he takes those home and his wife's like falling asleep at dinner, like shut the hell up. That's one of those things I'm needing to learn is like, hey, when you host a whole show and have to fill time and then go into everyday life, other people have things to say and they don't really need you to like monologue. So working on it. But as far as work and in general goes, like, I do think there are so many people who are just waiting for their turn to talk and they're not really listening to what the other person says, or they're so ready to like listen so they can give advice or tell them what they think. And it's been a lot more common lately to see people recognize the question is, do you just want to vent or do you want advice? Do you want me to just listen to you or do you want me to tell you what to do? Because sometimes people don't want advice. They want just someone to listen.
How do you tell the difference between somebody who wants advice and just somebody that wants you to listen?
To be honest with you, the best I can do is when it's a close friend. And if it's a close friend and it's something we've talked about before and they already know what I'm going to say, then I know they just want me to listen. But the best way is to ask. And that can be uncomfortable sometimes, especially for me, because I always think I can like fix the problem. Like they always say that like women have a tendency to just talk to each other and men always want to solve things. I'm a dude. Like when it comes to this stuff, I'm like, okay, well, here's how we're going to fix this. And they're like, we can just talk about it and like get it out and feel better just from talking about it. The other thing I would say is like understanding, which I told you I learned from my podcast, that the perspective of other people, even when you don't agree with it, can make you better at just being in spaces and rooms. Like I listened to almost every episode of We Can Do Hard Things with Abby Wambach and Glennon Doyle and Glennon's sister. And there are episodes that I look at the title or I look at the topic and I go, this one's going to annoy me or I'm going to have trouble with this one. And then by the end, I have learned so much about neurodivergent people, people with insane anxiety, people who are incredibly shy. Like I love Glennon, we're friends, but like she complains about the doorbell ringing and how much stress she has that someone might be at the door. And I'm like, what? That's not a thing to stress. There's a million things to stress over in life. Like you just don't answer the door. Maybe it's a package or maybe whatever. But because I respect and love her talent so much, I listen to the episodes and instead of judging people for these little things that used to bug me, instead I reconsider how I move through the world to be better for them and also to understand that they bring a totally different perspective. And that perspective gives me insight into the world in a way that I would never see it because I move through like a bull. Like, I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not shy. Let's like put on a show everywhere we go. And there's so many people who are going to bring something completely different because they aren't like that. And the older I get, the more I want to like listen to them instead of thinking that my way is the right way.
Why do you think it is that most, I'm going to bet that the majority of people, based on, I mean, just a wild guess, the majority of people are going to just listen to one news station or they're going to only read books of a certain genre, or if they see that a movie has an actress that they don't like, they're not going to go see it. Like, why do you think most people are like that? Because that's my gut. My gut tells me that most people are that way.
I'm going to go with confirmation bias. It feels really good to feel like you're right. And so if you listen to people who agree with you and read things that agree with you, then you get to just reinforce your idea that you know everything, which is a comforting feeling for a lot of people who don't want to keep learning and get uncomfortable by learning new stuff. And then the other one I would say is, I do think that it's scary to change your mind more so than ever. I think people used to change their mind a lot more, but the internet has seeped into everyday life where there's like a firmness of standing in whatever you said, even as the evidence starts to become clear that you were wrong. And I am such a know-it-all that this is hard for me. But like one of the things that being a personality and a pseudo celebrity is that people will call me out if I'm not consistent. I am aware if I'm being hypocritical because somebody remembers something I said 5 years ago. And I'm like, well, shit, I did say that. And instead of digging in my heels and making excuses, sometimes I just have to say, yeah, I kind of wish I hadn't said that because now I know a lot more. And here's how I feel now. Like, isn't that the best way to be, to say you're evolving and that you're learning and then it's changing your opinions on things? So I think that's really scary for people though, especially in the world of the internet where it's easier to say, this is how I feel. And I don't really want to learn why I'm wrong, but it's really dangerous as we can clearly see. It influences people to take really strong stances, dangerous ones that are endangering other people, and that stinks. But I get it. I mean, I think about things that over the last 10, 15 years, I've really evolved on, whether that's transgender people and really understanding that science now tells us that gender is not non-binary, that there's plenty of examples of not just intersex, which we already knew about, but really a sliding scale of gender in terms of like chromosomes and the way gonads work is not what we thought. Like all this science that's coming out, it's more annoying to learn people's pronouns than to just call them whatever you want. And it's more annoying to have difficult, nuanced, tough conversations about which rules should apply at which levels of sport for transgender athletes. But isn't that better than just being like, I'd prefer not to know anything and just live in the past? Like, that's how I feel, even if it's frustrating and sometimes scary to change your mind.
I'm a huge believer, Sarah, in the power of changing your mind, and that staying curious can help you do that. I'm also drawn to this idea that we've been talking about the past few minutes, and I think there's this undertone of problem solving also around the curiosity. I mean, you talked about it in the conversations with your friends, the difference between listening versus solving a problem. And I want to go back to a point early on in your career when you were working with the Blackhawks, you have the locker room access, you're doing these good stories, and then you lose the locker room access. Mm-hmm. And we can get into like why you lost the locker room access or why you think you lost the locker room access, and that whole piece of it sucks, right? But what I'm really curious about is, once you lost the locker room access, you came up with a way to get where you needed to go. You came up with a way to get to those conversations with those players. And in many instances, you did it in these like incredibly scrappy ways where you did things that like nobody else would be willing to do, like driving an hour and a half to an autograph signing that they were due with their permission, of course, to meet them and do this interview for 10 minutes. So take me back for the listeners, give them like a little bit of a backstory on what happened, why you think you lost access to the locker room, and then what compelled you to kind of go into problem solving mode and find a way. Because I find like so many people I talk to talk about this idea that on the other side of adversity is growth.
Right.
And anything you want, you have to be willing to push through these hurdles and find a way. How did you find a way? And tell me about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try to keep it short. I mean, this was 2008. I first moved back to Chicago. I was working for a startup company. It was when blogs were like evil and done out of someone's basement. That's how the mainstream media saw them. So they didn't have access to the locker rooms and to the teams. But because of the folks who had started this website that I worked for, who had connections that had been working in Chicago forever, we had access to the locker room. So it's my first time, because I didn't grow up wanting to be in sports and I didn't do it in college and go to a small market. My first time in a locker room was the Blackhawks, professional hockey at the highest level. And immediately, like, had a pretty good relationship with the players, just in the sense that I was the only person in their 20s. Everybody had been on the beat for a long time. And my role at the website was to do player personality stuff. It was supposed to be no spin, not connected to any major newspapers or networks in town, and get to know the players. And so I was asking them more fun questions alongside the serious stuff. It wasn't just about the power play. It was also, you know, I heard you guys had a Halloween party and Chris Versteeg sang all of Fergie's Glamorous Karaoke without any words. Like, what was that? Tell me about that. You know, that kind of stuff. It was really right when the Blackhawks were taking a turn, right before they won 3 Stanley Cups in like 8 years. So it was when everybody was hungry to know who they were. And I'd only been in there for maybe 2 weeks. And I started to get like different access from the PR folks. And someone that I sent in as a mole found out that one of the older reporters had said I must be sleeping with the players because they were giving me better answers. And then the Blackhawks saw a lot of the videos I was doing that were really fun and had their own Blackhawks TV behind the scenes that had just been straight coverage. And they started incorporating guys pranking each other and funny personality stuff. I'm not saying they wouldn't have thought about it on their own, but I do think that there was such a clamoring for the content I was making that was fun and about the players that they were like, oh, we should do more of that. And so then they said, we don't need to give you access anymore because we're doing this very same stuff for Blackhawks TV. Strange, could have done both. I wasn't sure how much it was connected to the reporter complaining about me, but I didn't have any option other than to get creative. I still needed to try to get the content. And so, like you said, I drove to this one autograph shop that they would all go to that was an hour and a half away, and it's winter. So add snow and ice and however else long I had to spend getting out there. At one point, at one of those, I told one of the players like that I had been blocked from coming out to the locker room anymore and that it was unfair. And so at one point, Duncan Keith and Christopher Stieg let me come to their house to do an interview. It was just I went to the NHL All-Star Awards and Versteeg's whole family was like, we wanted to meet you because it's so great that you have like made him a star and made it like everybody knows his personality and we know him to be so great. So we're glad everyone else is getting to know him too. So like, it was this push and pull of like, the fans really liked what I was doing. The players really liked it. And then there was this old stodgy BS that was still 15 years ago, the norm for me to walk into a locker room and be treated like crap. When I was working in the Cubs locker room for the same job, a woman that I knew was in the room and they said that my boobs were distracting and that they wanted to get me out of the clubhouse because of that. And she thankfully was in there and was like, this seems unfair to her that she can't just go in and do her job. And there was a lot of that when I started in Chicago. I was brand new. I hadn't been in the market working as an intern or anything. I just showed up and I'm in the clubhouses and I'm 6 feet tall. I do have big boobs. I stand out. And so I had to deal with all the stereotypes that people had warned me about that I kind of thought I was going to skip out on. I was like, oh, but I was an athlete and I'm, you know, really smart and I work hard. And that was a great lesson for me that it has nothing to do with the women who are at the mercy of the system. It has to do with the system itself being deeply flawed and that I was not going to be immune to that. It made me much more sensitive and empathetic to every other woman that has gone through that because she didn't do anything. It wasn't her fault. But I had to learn that. I kind of thought I was different because of my background. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stories of that kind of hustle. I managed to get a liquor company to pay for part of my airfare to go to the Super Bowl to cover it. I stayed in my friend's apartment that she had already moved out of that was empty. I bought a shower curtain at Walgreens. I stole internet from the neighbor. There was no microwave, no refrigerator. So I just had like plain food. I packed a pillow, slept on her floor. Like I was willing to do whatever it took to get to the places. I had a friend that I used to work with in LA on Radio Row that put me down as a guest on their show every day for a week so that I could get into Radio Row. And then I set up on an empty table and tried to interview people for my own show. So yeah, I got a lot of sneaky tricks when people don't let me in. And to your point of why I felt so compelled to do that, I'm not that person that's like, tell me no and watch what happens. But I am someone who's like, on principle, if something is wrong and unfair, that is like the guiding light for so much of what I care about in life. It's why I always try to bring a lot of social issues into the sports stuff I do, because it would feel empty to just cover sports without figuring out how to make it bigger and more impactful. And so when it was like, this is BS, I'm getting mistreated based on nothing that has to do with my work. So now I'm going to work extra hard and I'm going to crush it so that when I come back around, which I did with an ESPN mic flag instead of a startup website, they can't say no, which they didn't. And some of the very same people were like, oh, I just saw you on Oberman or Outside the Lines or whatever. That was great. I'm like, okay, well, I've always been great. You just were being dicks.
I mean, you got it, Sarah. I'm curious, what do you think it is about your ability to find and tell great stories? Because in a minute or two, I want to get to the book that you're writing. And you've told many, many tremendous stories. That book is going to be fantastic. I'm like on pins and needles waiting to read it. But you have this unique ability to find and tell incredible stories. And I'm like all in on storytelling. I think that storytelling, no matter what discipline you're in, no matter what your job is, no matter what you do or who you interact with, if you can become a better storyteller, that makes you a more engaging person. That makes you more helpful to people. It makes you, you know, have this ability to inspire others and entertain others, which is also really, really important in the world that we live in. How do you have this ability to find and tell great stories?
I completely agree with that, by the way. We pitched a panel for South by Southwest that was how to use the skills of politics to use storytelling to change long-held and wrong narratives. And it was like thinking about the way that politicians and political teams use very specific anecdotes and storytelling to try to spin people to change their mind about something or to feel a certain way about something, and how you could use that for things like dumb stereotypes about the value of women's sports as a business or women in STEM or all sorts of other things that like we really need to hammer away at things that have been so long held and ingrained in society that they're damaging even future generations because they're still sort of ingesting them. I just think telling stories and being entertaining and being specific about things is how you sell people on anything, whether it's literally sales for your job or anything else, getting money for your charity, whatever it is. So I would say probably One is the curiosity, because it gives me the desire to find details and information and to learn about stuff that I can then bring into any of those spaces. And the other is empathy. I sometimes, to a fault, I cry at everything. I cry at commercials. I cry at books. I cry at stories I see. Like, I feel very deeply. It prevents me from watching most shows that everyone loves, because I like can't sleep and I can't stop thinking about it. If it's dark and it's too much like real life, I start to think about all the people who might be actually dealing with that in real life. And I'm like, I can't do it. So like, my husband watches all these shows by himself, like Barry and things with like murder, even if they're funny. I'm like, nope, too dark. So I think empathy, I think trying to, and I'm also fascinated by human beings. Like, I always say that if I wasn't doing Saturday Night Live or some entertainment thing, I would want to be a psychologist or a behavioral psychologist. Like, I'm fascinated by why people do things, what motivates them. I'm just really interested in interpersonal dynamics and how different people end up where they are, which is why my podcast ended up being basically just getting to be nosy and grilling people about their lives and every choice they ever made and how they got there. So I would say it's that. It's empathy and really trying to understand someone to tell their story and tell it right and make them feel good about it. And then also sense of humor, right? I think that gets you so many places in terms of getting to know the people that you want to tell their story and then also telling it in a way that people like want to receive.
You always, like, as long as you can remember, have you always had a great sense of humor?
Yes. I had to, because I was already 6 feet tall when I was 12. I was awkward. I had curly hair. I had braces. I towered over everybody. I talked too much. Like, I literally was going through my garage and boxes that my mom had dropped off during COVID and was like, please, these are on you now. Like, keep them or get rid of them, but it's not up to us. And I was going through all these old report cards and they were like, Sarah's so great and she studies really hard and she knows all the answers, but she won't shut the F up. Like, just like every teacher was like, just simmer down. So I haven't learned from that, obviously, as I continue to talk, but I always knew that I stood out in a way that was uncomfortable, especially for a girl. Like, it's hard to be uncomfortable, especially like early on when you're like going through puberty and you're awkward and have no way of blending. Like, you're just going to stand out over everybody. And that's why I got so much joy out of sports, because it was a really great like use of my body and like making my body do what I wanted it to instead of how other people were receiving it. That's the other thing. I was like very young and tall with big boobs, and I was not like into that yet, but men didn't know that I was young. So I would get hit on by men a lot when I was like 13. And I was like, what's even happening? Like, I didn't even really understand it until I did. And then I was like really grossed out and uncomfortable. And so I think I just have always needed to use humor in those uncomfortable circumstances. My dad's very funny. My dad would never let the truth get in the way of a funny story, not in a bad way, but like, we're notorious, like just stretch it a little for the laugh kind of, you know. And I grew up being obsessed with Saturday Night Live. So Eddie Murphy, Saturday Night Live, Eddie Murphy, Delirious, all the best of Saturday Night Lives from 70s, 80s, like all those VHS, that was just a constant. I would read David Letterman's biography when I was like 10 to try to learn how you could grow up and host a TV show. So I was probably necessity. And then it ended up being super useful in my career too, because all the sexual harassment and all the BS, the best way to get through that is humor. If you just reject someone to their face, that could be the end of your career. If you find a clever and funny way to be playful, even in the worst moments, it's a little less difficult for whatever that person in power that's being an a-hole is trying to accomplish.
Do you think people can build a sense of humor muscle, or is it something that... No.
I mean, maybe a little bit, but no. Sorry to anyone out there who isn't funny if I just crushed your dreams of working out.
You may have crushed some dreams. You may have crushed some dreams, but you've always been a straight shooter.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to beat around the bush. I don't think some people who are not funny are ever really going to figure it out. I think it's like
5 years from now, when you say something on ESPN about people having the ability to grow their sense of humor.
Oh my, I can't wait. I hope that's the case. I hope they like do a research study, because there's a lot of people who need it.
Sarah Spain in 2023 said you can't develop a sense of humor. But you know what? Even if somebody's out there listening saying, I was hoping to learn from Sarah how to develop a better sense of humor, you've still dropped so much wisdom and inspiration in this conversation that there's a lot for them to work with in other facets of their life. But Sarah, you've been so generous with your time. Before I let you go, I want to talk about one of the most powerful stories that you've ever told, and you're continuing to tell it. It's the story of Dylan McCullough. It's a phenomenal, remarkable. I can't even do it justice to describe the story here, but we will link to the first story that you did about it in the show notes, and obviously you're working on a book. So I want to ask, how did you first come across Dylan's story? What led you to dive so deep into that story in particular? And what made you say, I'm going to go even further? I'm going to write a book on this story.
This story was a gift and it has taught me a ton. This is one of the biggest lessons that I'll give people is do not put up false or imagined barriers for your own success because you're afraid or because you don't believe you can. There's a million different things in my career that if you told me 20 years ago, you're going to win an Emmy and a Peabody and you're going to host your own show, like all these things, I wouldn't have asked for or said I wanted any of those things for fear that it would be embarrassing when I came nowhere near. And now I look back and I'm like, that's really dumb. My friend Skip, Trey Montana, played college football with Dylan. And so when Dylan went on this remarkable journey to find his dad, and it turned out his dad was his college coach and mentor of 30 years all along, but neither of them knew it. He called up his old teammates. He's like, hey guys, you're not going to believe this. Coach was my dad. So, you know, spoiler alert, the story's already out there. But so Skip immediately called me. I was like, I got to tell you this story. This has to be on ESPN somehow. So I first pitched it to 30 for 30, not really realizing that 30 for 30 is what happened when, and E60 is more what's happening now. So they sent me to the E60 folks. And the biggest lesson I learned from this was, you know, I had done smaller features, the 2 to 6 minute ones for SportsCenter. I'd not done a full like 20 plus minute feature. I wasn't even worried about it. I was like, I got it. Just, it's the same thing, same basic. And I'll be working with a great editor, great producer. They're going to walk me through this first time of doing this long form. What worried me was the written piece. I said, oh, we got to have a written piece with this. And I'm a writer. And I was still like, but I've never written like 6,000 words. I've only done shorter ones. And I legitimately almost in this meeting said, do you think you should get Mina Kimes or like Wright Thompson to do it? Because they were such incredible writers. I'd read so many of their long form magazine pieces that I was worried I was going to screw it up. And then I thought to myself, you're a writer. That's your job. Like, don't sell yourself short. Just try to do it. And I ended up winning a bunch of awards, writing awards, and got a book deal. And now I'm writing a book. So it's like, again, with the stop getting in your own way, this is, you know, no offense to you as a white man, but I do have to in my head over and over say, like, have the confidence of a white man. Like the number of dudes that are just like, I'll figure that out. I'll do it. I mean, every research study shows that women are overqualified and still won't submit themselves for jobs because societal conditioning has told us over and over that we're not good enough, that we shouldn't ask for that, that we shouldn't expect it. And so literally every time I'm like going to doubt myself, I'm like, I got this. I'm just going to do it. When have I failed? And I have once or twice had moments that I didn't do as well as I had hoped, but like for the most part, knock on wood, like I show up for myself and I get the job done. I do it better than I ever could have expected. So I got to stop getting in the way. And so when the book deal came around this year, they originally wanted it back when the story came out in 2016, I think it was, maybe 2017. And I was busy with all the other jobs and we actually have optioned it into a feature film. We're currently looking for a studio to work with. Russell Wilson and Sierra are executive producing. Macro is the main studio that we're, or the production company we're working with. We wanted to do that first and then the book, but we've stalled on the feature film side because of COVID. And like we were taking meetings and it was like, will it be in a movie theater? Will movie theaters exist? So we need to revisit all the pitches now that times have gotten back to normal a little bit more. But the woman who most wanted it of the editors left for Simon & Schuster. And immediately when she got there, called again and said, I still really want this book. And I was like, perfect timing. I've got more time on my hands. I want to say yes now before I say yes to other things and can't do it. And so that's been a lot of this year. Draft is due in March. Very different workflow, but it's been such an awesome lesson for me, learning a whole different set of skills and also just like being willing to take a chance. And I mean, if it sucks, it'll really suck. It'll be like so much time spent on something and everyone will be like, that's the greatest story ever. How did you screw that up? And I'll be like, well, I guess this is the time that I should have said no, but we'll find out.
Well, I'm a big believer in the idea of why not? Right. And thinking, what's the worst that's going to happen? And I, since he told me, since I'm going to share a story that listeners have heard, but I share it so often with anybody that I'm talking to who's kind of wrestling with an idea of should I do this or should I do that, is Jim Sonnefeld, the drummer in Hootie and the Blowfish, who's a 2-time Grammy winner. He told me the story about when he was a kid, his drum teacher suggested he enroll in this drum contest. Mm-hmm. And him and his parents and the drum teacher drive hours, probably 6 hours to this drum contest. And he's afraid to get out of the car because he doesn't think he's capable and competent enough. And I asked him, I said, what did the, ultimately he goes in and he wins. Yeah. And then he ends up going to University of South Carolina. He gets linked up with Darius Rucker and the rest of the guys in Hootie and the Blowfish. They go on to, they still have one of the top 10 selling albums of all time, Cracked Rearview, and the rest is history. And I said, what happened like in that car that made you go in? He said, the drum teacher looked at me and he said, why not?
Yeah.
Like, why not?
Yeah.
And to me, that's a powerful story. And I see a lot of that in all the things that you've done so far in your career.
Well, that's one of the huge things I learned from my podcast. I have such a fear of failure. I have way too much pride. And I always worry about, like, not in the sense of not doing things. Like, I'll go on around the horn in front of like a couple million people and be like, yeah, we'll see what happens. Right. I don't get nervous like that, but I have a sense of like, I need to feel so prepared and ready before I put myself out there sometimes. And I worry, oh, if I didn't do that well, all the bad things that would happen. And the answer is like, not a lot. And people move on. And what my podcast taught me was how many really successful people had stories of failure and don't dwell on them. A lot of them don't remember them. When I would ask, what's your biggest failure? They'd be like, oh, I can't really, but I learned so much from that. And I'm like, yeah, exactly. Like, that's why you're so successful, but still tell us about when you got fired or when this happened. And that was also really useful for me too, because I have had this really great career trajectory. And I kept telling myself, like, whether it's COVID or otherwise, like, things can change and I need to be ready for that, instead of being so tied up in the identity of I'm ESPN Sarah Spain and this is what I do. And it's just going to keep going like this forever, that I'll get knocked off my block if something comes up. And this year, when my contract changed, in part because I wanted to change my radio and in part because an exec didn't want me doing stuff anymore, it was a huge blow to my ego. But then it put me on this path to do all these other things. And I'm fine, right? Like, I want to tell people it's okay if like this thing that you didn't ask for or want happens, to figure out what it's telling you and what it allows you to do instead. But if I hadn't listened to all those stories from successful people on my podcast talking about when they screwed something up or lost something that they wanted, didn't get the job, all these other things, I think I would have been blindsided and terrified. And instead, I gave myself 2 days to be like, all right, that's not cool. And then I was like, awesome, what am I going to do now? How am I going to still work at ESPN in the capacities that I do have a contract for? Love that. How do I find other things that I've been wanting to do and haven't been able to do? And so it's been like a super awesome year of growth because of that. And I had to spend years of blissful happiness preparing myself for that. Not in a negative sense of waiting for the shoe to drop, but in a thoughtful sense of, oh, my friend Jamel is on my podcast talking about how her career at ESPN ended and she had not planned on that. What can I take from this conversation? What would I think if that happened? How would I feel? This person I love just got fired. Wow, that's shocking. Like, what would I do if that were me? And never thinking that it couldn't happen to me, because it was better to go through the exercise of like, how would I react and how do I prepare myself for it?
All right. This has been such a fun and humbling conversation. I've learned so much. I still think, despite all that you've accomplished, you're still in the first or second inning of the Sarah,
all right,
of the Sarah Spain story.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
I can't wait and can't even imagine where it goes from here, but I can't wait to see the book. I know so many listeners cannot wait to read the book and listen to the book, however people consume books these days. And we'll have to do a part two sometime, because like I said, you're only in the first or second inning of the Sarah Spain story.
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me on, and thanks for the support on the book. I'm going to need everyone. I guess it's like all about pre-orders. That's what I've learned so far, even though we're well off of that. So eventually I'll be asking everyone I've ever met to pre-order.
Well, you are forever a part of the Everybody Pulls the Tarp community. You're a tarp puller forever.
Yes.
And we'll make sure we support you and turn out to read and listen to that book wherever folks get books. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of tart pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today is a great day to pull the tarp. I am rooting for you. See you next time.